Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. An all-encompassing look at the Caribbean music known as reggae unfolds within the pages of The Encyclopedia of Reggae, The Golden Age of Roots Reggae, by our guest, Dr. Mike Alain, Professor of Recording Industry. This is a reference book full of information, but it's also colorful, full of photos, and includes a foreword by drummer Lowell Sly Dunbar. We'll talk about reggae's reach from Jamaica and beyond, from Abyssinians to Tapazuki, after a few jamming words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. A U.S. post office in Mountain View, California will be named for an MTSU alumnus. On January 10th, President Obama signed into law a measure to rename the facility the Lieutenant Kenneth N. Ballard Memorial Post Office. Ballard was killed in Iraq in 2004. He also served in Bosnia and Macedonia. This month, Middle Tennessee Education Center in Shelbyville will offer four agriculture classes designed for students interested in one of Tennessee's most diversified economic fields. The classes are soil, agriculture in our lives, introduction to agribusiness, and elements of animal science. And Kane and D-Rock, also known as the Ying Yang Twins, will perform at MTSU's Tucker Theater February 7th. Tickets are on sale now at mtsu.edu/events. And for MTSU News at any time, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Alain, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
How would you define reggae?
It's very difficult to define, and this was one of the challenges, descriptive challenges of the book, because it has many different facets, but it is something that is spiritual in many ways. Mm-hmm. Very rhythmically motivating and very ideologically powerful as well. So I can't think of one all-encompassing sentence, which is, of course, why I had to write the 352-page book.
Right.
But it's a very important music historically because it is really the first music from what people like to call the Third World, though that's a phrase I don't like to use.
Right. Global South, I think, is the accepted version now.
Yes, the international music that was able to penetrate the major Western commercial markets at a time when that was very uncommon. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of ways in which reggae sets new landmarks.
There is an unquestionable spirituality about it that even those of us who are familiar with pop music and reggae only as a fringe element of American pop music can detect. But if there's one thing that stands out to me about reggae is the beat. You can't mistake reggae's beat for any other genre of music, can you?
Probably not. Not if you're familiar with how reggae should sound. Mm-hmm. It still has many different kinds of configurations as the music becomes more and more global, and there are more fusions, and the music has become more digital and electronic. But the essence of it is always this sort of very rootsy, rhythmic interlocking, and it's a music that you have to feel in order to play it properly.
I was a DJ in the 70s and 80s, and it seems to me that that was a particularly deep time for American pop music hits that had integrated reggae into their sounds, more so than today. Eric Clapton covered Bob Marley's I Shot the Sheriff. There was Stir It Up by Johnny Nash. Was a big hit. Electric Avenue by Eddie Grant was a big hit in this country. Is the influence of reggae on American or Western music still strong, or has it waned?
It's still strong, and in some ways, even though its visibility may not be as great, you could actually say it's getting stronger, because now you have a lot more American artists who are taking on the reggae mantle and actually outselling the Jamaican reggae artists in America. So I'm thinking of acts like the Jewish Hasidic artist Matis Yahu, or The Green from Hawaii, I believe, who had one of the top-selling reggae albums last year in America, and actually did reach the top of Billboard's reggae charts. And also a group like Revolution. So there's a movement happening now that wasn't happening in the 70s, because those were the earliest days and people were just beginning to experiment with some of those elements. I suppose I should also mention that sometimes, and Eddie Grant has spoken about this several times as well, that sometimes there are artists whose physical appearance fits the reggae mold, but whose music doesn't necessarily fit in. You mentioned Electric Avenue, mm-hmm. which is a very energetic track, but I always think of that more as a rock track.
Yeah.
But, you know, because Eddie Grant's dreadlocks tend to overpower his image, you know, and because he did break through commercially as a solo artist in Europe with reggae hits, mm-hmm. there's the tendency for audiences generally, as I've mentioned in the book, to see him more as a reggae artist when in fact he's reggae plus, uh-huh. you know.
Are there such things as reggae purist, such people, I should say, as reggae purists who don't like to see fusions of other genres of music mix in with what they believe should be straight reggae?
I suspect there still are. I think I've been mistaken for one of those at one point or another. But because, you know, I had written an article that dealt with many of the 70s releases that you were discussing, the Eric Clapton cover of I Shot the Sheriff, Paul Simon's Mother and Child Reunion that came out 2 years before that.
Right.
Some of Paul McCartney's work with Wings, the Eagles, Hotel California.
Now, a lot of Americans don't really think, they don't think reggae when they hear Hotel California. They still think, I think they tend to think that's more of a Mexican influence on the California-based rock of the Eagles than they think reggae.
I think you're absolutely right. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote that article, because I think I had someone tell me that they couldn't hear the reggae in the song. And I found that
mind-boggling.
Yes, it was astonishing. So I thought, no, I have to deal with this in a more clinical, academic way so that mm-hmm. someone at least will look at it and say, oh, yes, that's where it is.
But there aren't that many, you think, who will look at the music of the baby boomers, will look at the music of the Police and say, oh, well, it's just a white boy from London trying his best to be a reggae artist, and his ego outstrips his ability to do so. Or do they admire Sting for what he's done with it?
Well, you know, it's very interesting you should mention the Police and Sting, because I'm actually working on a paper that I'm going to be presenting in Jamaica next month. That deals with the Police. Well, the title of the paper is Reggae in the Material World, The mm-hmm. Police Revisited. Specifically, it looks at four albums released between 1997 and 2008 that are tribute albums to the Police that mm-hmm. feature reggae artists.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, of course, the first two were instigated by Sting's manager, who was also the manager of the Police, who also had an interest in the publishing. But at the same time, the artists were willing to participate in that because they welcomed the opportunity to reinterpret the interpretation of reggae that the Police had come up with. Mm-hmm. You had asked a question about purists a while ago, and I think that people who tend to, like myself, who tend to critique the contribution of the Police are sometimes mistaken as being purists. It's not that. It's just that it's interesting to see how a rock group can integrate reggae elements and mm-hmm. achieve this incredible commercial success, but reggae groups who will integrate rock are never able to do that.
Yeah, I wonder if there's some kind of ethnocentrism going on there with that.
Oh, definitely. And that's been one of the things I have been looking at over the course of my academic career, just trying to highlight where some of the discrepancies are and draw more attention to them.
We'll be back with more on the Encyclopedia of Reggae right after this. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle East Center at MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. Mike Aline, Professor of Recording Industry here at MTSU and author of the Encyclopedia of Reggae. Do you think American music fans understand the political roots or ramifications of reggae?
Well, some do, but my feeling is that reggae has this aura of exoticism that isn't always clearly connected by sectors of the audience to a harsh political and economic reality. Those realities really created the conditions for the music. And without those situations, it's debatable whether reggae would have come out sounding the way it did when it did.
Mm-hmm. So it is really a genre that is a creation of politics or political revolution or political rebellion, more so than, say, the folk music that inspired Woody Guthrie or Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young in the 60s. I mean, they were adapting political messages to an already existing genre instead of the genre springing from the politics.
Yes. Reggae coincides with a very difficult post-independence era in Jamaica, where the, you know, Jamaica became an independent nation, getting its political freedom from Britain in 1962. Mm-hmm. But as we know from history, political freedom does not equal economic freedom.
Right.
And the situation was such that the promise of independence had not been fulfilled, and the social disillusionment was able to translate itself through the musicians, who were themselves part of the underclass isn't quite the right word, but because they weren't part of the establishment, mm-hmm. They understood what the average person was dealing with. And they had come, most of those musicians, from very tough backgrounds and were able to sort of synthesize the emotional climate and elements of the emotional climate and the feelings of the people and put all of that into a form that was tangible, that resonated with the core audience.
It seems, though, that when reggae gets beyond the borders of Jamaica, that when the song grabs you, you can understand it and appreciate it without necessarily fully understanding the politics. It's just that if you understand the politics, you appreciate it on a deeper level.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there are people who may have very limited familiarity with Jamaica as an island or any aspect of its history, but who have an intuitive appreciation of the reggae rhythm and style and attitude. And really, that's all artists are asking for, that, you know, you get into the music if you find other means of exploring the background, then that's fine. But really, I think artists are just interested in having their audiences feel part of the music.
You have a section on women in reggae in the encyclopedia. Is it hard for women to break into reggae or to become highly successful and visible in reggae?
I'd say it still is. There have been notable exceptions over the years, but again, when you look at the overall population of artists, women are still in a minority situation in reggae and still having to deal with stereotypes about, you know, the lyrical and ideological subject matter. So, and of course, there are very few women who in the history of reggae have been able to own record labels or own studios or be involved in production. So we have to look at what's going on behind the scenes as well as the artist situation. Now, again, there are notable exceptions, and you have a number of women who have been involved in artist management or who have worked with major American labels. But generally speaking, it's still very much a fringe situation.
Are the women who are at the top of their game in reggae, or the most popular women in the genre, are their lyrics political and feminist, or are they mostly about love relationships?
I guess from my male point of view, I'd see them as being love relationships and feminist.
I say bring a feminist tone to love relationships.
Yes, because the power dynamics of the love relationship are decentered from the male, where the woman is represented as having control and direction and vision and power. And this is something that had been missing before. Now, sometimes as a result of the effort to convey this power, the lyrics can take some very challenging turns that would limit airplay.
I see.
So, I mean, again, this is not to stereotype all female reggae artists, but there are some notable examples of this that raise some issues.
Yeah. There are several pictures in the book of vehicles and lean-to buildings with sound equipment in them, sound systems, and microphones, playback units, all sorts of things. If the music, it seems like if the music is important enough, they'll find a way to get the necessary equipment regardless of the economic circumstances. Does that hold true?
I think so. It's very much an improvised music. All of the situations are improvised. And, you know, it's actually quite remarkable that the music has had such a great historical resonance because it was done with the bare minimum of equipment. If we're talking about the golden age of roots reggae, which, of course, is the book's subtitle, then we're talking about people working with four-track machines or two tracks when in America and England, the top acts were recording on 16 or 24-track machines with budgets.
Yeah.
So for this music to still have cultural and commercial currency in the 21st century, that's quite an achievement.
We'll have more in just a moment about the Encyclopedia of Reggae. We'll be back on MTSU on the Record right after this.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE Advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Michael Lean is the author of the Encyclopedia of Reggae. He's a professor of recording industry here. Did you just edit this or did you write all of the entries yourself?
I wrote all of the entries. So I actually wrote the book as opposed to being the editor.
And the photography in it is, the layout is so vibrant and it's so eye-catching. It's one of those things that you really, you can't put it down. Was the layout and photo selection your idea as well, or did you have an illustrator?
Oh, no. The credit for that actually goes to a New York-based company called Sideshow Books. They were hired by Sterling Publishing, which is the overall publisher, to put the project together. And so it was Sideshow that procured my services, and they are the ones who dealt with the licensing and acquisition of all of the graphics from the various archives and did the editing, where I had to revise 3, 4, 5 times various entries. But, you know, the result is there. I should mention that they are also responsible for the layout.
Well, it's really addictive. When you hear the word encyclopedia, some people tend to nod off, but you won't nod off when you look at this one. It will captivate your attention from page to page to page. Let me ask you, why ganja is such an important part of the whole reggae mystique?
Well, apart from the fact that people like to internationally like to transgress you know, legal regulations,
they've been known to do that from time to time.
Its importance in terms of reggae is this sort of paradox in which Orthodox Rastafarians see it as a holy sacrament and the law enforcement authorities see it as a flagrant violation.
Right. Like American Indians using peyote buttons as a part of their naturalistic religion.
Precisely.
Right.
You know, and it's the way that it doesn't interface with the larger societal situations.
And apparently Jamaican law does not have anything like our First Amendment assuring freedom of religion.
Indeed.
That would protect the ganja smokers, the Rastafarians.
Yes, it's an interesting point you make, because in years gone by, certainly in the era of early reggae and the decades preceding it, those who were Rastas were outlaws in the society. Mm. You know, police would beat them up and cut off their dreadlocks because they were seen as being completely at the other end of the spectrum from what was then still the colonial ideal.
And that is analogous to people cutting off the queue of the Chinese, the pigtail of the Chinese, who believe that it put them in bad stead with their ancestors for them not to have a long tail. That's another ethnocentric, you know, infringement, if you will, upon someone's religious beliefs.
Yes, and it has taken a while for the Rastafarian community to negotiate enough space within Jamaican society, and I'm sure there are many who will say that that's still an ongoing process. Mm-hmm. But you have a point now where someone who's wearing locks will not be frowned upon as a complete alien mm-hmm. in mainstream society.
It's interesting to me because while lots of people smoke herb while they're listening to all different kinds of music, I've never heard of one particular substance being so deeply associated with one particular genre as ganja is with reggae. Is that not the case?
I'd say it is. I can't think of any examples in any other genre of music where you have what is perceived as a drug being taking on religious and spiritual implications mm-hmm. and being an integral part of the music and having songs coming out of the genre of music dedicated.
Yes, to that substance. Yes. By the way, why do you pass the Dutchie on the left-hand side as opposed to the right-hand side?
I have no idea, but I think the Mighty Diamond song, I'm not sure of the extent to which it was based on the actuality of passing what actually was originally the coochie rather than the Dutchie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as legend has it, the Dutchie is serving food, whereas the coochie is the actual ganja.
Uh-huh.
So...
I'm talking about, I'm not familiar with Pass the Coochie, but the only thing that I've seen, of course, is the musical youth mm-hmm. Video in which they sang Pass the Dutchie, and apparently you couldn't have children that age singing Pass the Coochie.
Oh, no. That wouldn't work, and, in their case, it turned out to be very commercially viable for them. Mm-hmm. But it's worth noting that the type of pop reggae that they came out with hasn't worn very well with time mm. because it really was very much a diluted sound.
Uh-huh.
You know, less roots and more
right.
pop.
Yeah. So this isn't sort of any sort of ganja protocol that you have to pass it on the left-hand side as opposed to the right-hand side. It's just a lyric?
Well, as someone who doesn't partake in any kind of smoking, I would have to confess ignorance where this is concerned.
Okay. he pleads the Fifth Amendment on this one, folks. We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record in just a moment.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
The Encyclopedia of Reggae, The Golden Age of Roots Reggae, is the book we're talking about, written by Dr. Mike Aline and published by Sterling Publishers. Dr. Mike Aline is a professor of recording industry here. And this is an ordinary encyclopedia because in the back it not only has a timeline of reggae's development, but it has several top 10 and top 25 lists in different categories. This is all your opinion, right?
Yes, it is.
These are all your opinions. These top 20 5 list and top 10 list. They're the top 10 best songs about ganja, the best album covers. You've even got the best dreadlocks in here. All kinds of categories. Were you just having fun with it, or were you just are you trying to make a statement as someone who's studied this very intensely?
Really, it's a bit of both. The lists were the publisher's idea. They felt that there should be this this other accessible component to help audiences focus on things that might be familiar to them or not, but give them points of reference if they wanted to listen further or if they were just curious to see what was on the list. Mm-hmm. But it's very subjective, and I do go to some pains to emphasize that at various points during those lists, that this is, you know, my perspective, and these are not meant to be definitive lists, but they are starting points. And as a result, I did not want to rank those releases in a particular order other than alphabetical.
Right, I see. Okay, so these are just 10 in a group, and you can rank them from 1 to 10 any which way you want, or add and subtract others as you see fit. And we can't leave this subject without talking about Bob Marley. You can rank your top 5 rock guitarists of all time, and most people will put Jimi Hendrix at the top. And you can write Clapton is God on the wall all you want to, but I don't know of any one musician who is more deeply associated with his genre of music than Bob Marley. He really is the godfather of it all, is he not?
He is. But there are many godfathers of reggae,
okay,
which is part of the motivation behind writing the book. Now, in terms of its international commercial breakthrough, mm-hmm. then Bob is the godfather. Mm-hmm. But, you know, his apprenticeship in musical performance and songwriting mm-hmm. came from those who were there before.
But I think we in the West, who are on the fringes of reggae appreciation, believe that he is so deeply revered by reggae artists that we see him as the shining light to which others aspire.
Yes, I mean, there is a real sense in which he is the definitive reggae icon. Mm-hmm. The problem, or perhaps I should say the challenge, is that it's very difficult to get most audiences to look beyond Bob Marley and to look at other artists and groups whose influence was perhaps not as major as Bob's on an international scale, but was nonetheless significant. You did mention this analogy with Jimi Hendrix, mm-hmm. and I wanted to mention that the very colorful cover of the book was designed by a guy called Phil Yarnell, who does all of the design work for the Hendrix family in the state, so that every time you see a new Jimi Hendrix repackage, mm-hmm. he's the guy who's done it. So it's an interesting bridge between icons there, Hendrix and Marley.
Dr. Michael Lean, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.